Morning. I'm hopeful of covering an overview of the Bible beginning this evening and ending up on Friday. Needless to say, it's going to be pretty compressed. But the approach I'd like to take on this is look at it from the standpoint of various periods of time in which God dealt with man. Ages, if we could put it that way. I think most of us have a general understanding of three basic ages, ages that we call the age of the patriarchs, and the reason we call that is because there's a period of time beginning with, or at least in the example in Genesis, we see Abel offering a more excellent sacrifice than that of Cain. He offered the firstlings of his flock, and we see this pattern of a dominant male figure, usually the head of the family, offering sacrifice. We see this in the book of Job. We see this with Abraham. We see this with those who were of that period of time. And then we have a more focused system of worship, another age we refer to as the Law of Moses. And usually there's kind of a concept of the patriarchal age overarching the Law of Moses, the Gentiles still kind of carrying on to what extent they were able, and then the Hebrew people living under that covenant given to Moses. And then we consider the last days, this covenant that we have through Jesus Christ. So three basic ages that we tend to look at, but I'd like to kind of divide this down a little bit further and just consider some little slices of time in these ages, and they had their own peculiar characteristics, and I'm hopeful that we can cover that through this week. Tonight, I'd like to look at the period of time before the flood, the pre-flood era. It's a period of time lasted about 1,600 years. And only in a few chapters, we're covering 1,600 years, so there's a lot of stuff. And there's, I guess you could say, vital information with regard to the roots of our being are contained in this chapter, because it has to do with our origins. It has to do with the essential seed that God planted when he created us, and the potential in that seed, what he had in mind for it to become. And there are many things to consider in these first few chapters. So it may seem a little bit unbalanced tonight. We'll be spending a lot of time in the first few chapters, and we're thinking, well, there's so many other chapters in the Bible. How are we going to get the rest of it through the week? Well, we'll decompress as we go along and consider a few other things throughout the Bible. Hopefully we'll get a good scan after all is said and done. I think of this beginning that we have in Genesis, the first chapter, and I don't mean to be cute. I know this sounds cute, but I don't mean it to be this way. But to me, it might be better to think of it as the beginning of the beginning, from the standpoint that this was all of this time that we live in, from Genesis right through the very judgment day. All of this is a creation period. It's a period of development for God's new creation to come into existence, for the final thing that he has in mind for us to be. All of this is preparatory. What happened when God said, "Let there be light," to when Jesus comes in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God. All of this in between is preparatory. It's for the sake of us coming to know God and learning the limitations of our existence and taking hold of the grace of life and being born again, being made anew. It was in God's mind from the very beginning. Before he said, "Let there be light," it must have been that this plan was in his head, if you want to call it that way. If you'll turn with me to the book of Ephesians, I'd like to just consider a passage in the first chapter of the book. Here it tells us that God chose us in him. Now, this is in Ephesians 1 and verse 4. He chose us in him before the foundation of the world that we should be holy and without blame before him in love. When it says before the foundation of the world, this means before the establishment of something like a deposition, something that's laid out beforehand, a plan, something that he worked out all the details, the foundation. Before the foundation of the world, he chose us that we should be holy and without blame before him in love. In other words, the object of his affection was first in his mind before the plan. At least that's the way it reads to me. He wanted us. He desired us. He had this love to create beings that would be after his own kind, with whom he could identify, and they with him. If you could call it an eternal conversation among God and his children, and glory and goodness and light. apparently this was in his mind, and then before the foundation of the world, it says. So the foundation came afterward. The deposition or the laying down of the plan came afterward. So it must mean that even when he said, let there be light, he knew that it would require his son to become flesh, to become incarnate, to come and become one of us in order that that creation might come into being. He knew that that would be the cost, and evidently he was willing for that. This does cite to a certain extent the amount of love that he has for us. Okay, let's go to Genesis chapter 1. It says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the water. Then God said. We have elements of God's being already displayed here, don't we? We have God. We have the idea of this being who brings life into existence. And then we have a spirit, the Spirit of God, hovering over the face of the waters. And then we have this little verb, said, which implies what? It implies the word, doesn't it? It implies there's a word that's active. It tells us in the book of John, in the first chapter, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the same was in the beginning, and the Word was God, the same was in the beginning with God. All things were made with Him, by Him, and without Him was nothing made that was made. In other words, the Word was there when God said, let there be light. And in verse 4, it says, God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the beginning, the evening and the morning were the first day. Now think of how light, the light that we appreciate comes into being. It says it was divided from the darkness. Perhaps this is just looking at semantics or just the syntax, and maybe it really means nothing in and of itself. But to me it suggests that the light we're looking at here is not the eternal light of God. It's shrouded in this word that Solomon, in his wisdom, perceived. It's shrouded in the word vanity, a futile light, a light that was never meant to last for eternity, a temporary light, a light that would come into being for a while and then be taken away forever, because it isn't the substance of God's dwelling. It's not the substance of his home. It's not the substance of his being. Though he created it, though it originated in him, he created something temporary. Something that is not everlasting. Is he capable of doing this? Evidently so. This is not everlasting. Flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. And yet he's able to bring it into being for a time, for a purpose that it might serve. And many things God has done this way. They are not everlasting. The law of Moses is this way. It was not everlasting. The things that God performs in such a fashion are kind of like a form for pouring concrete. Now, I'm no construction guy. I know very little. I used to be a grunt, and I know about that. People telling me what to do, and I'd do it. But as far as actually being involved in construction, I haven't done much, but I have seen forms, wooden or metal pieces that are set up and they're braced to form a mold so that concrete can be poured in. And the form itself takes the general shape of the object that you have in mind to produce. You have a Jell-O mold, it's the same thing, or an angel food cake mold, it's the same thing. It has the general shape of the object that you desire to produce, but you don't eat the cake pan when it's over, you don't eat the Jell-O mold, and you don't live on the form for the foundation of the house. Those things are taken away because they serve only a temporary purpose. The object that you have in mind is what you want, and I believe that's what we're looking at here. He divided the light from the darkness, which indicates darkness is the fundamental reality of all of this. And isn't that what it says? The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Why is it worded this way? Why doesn't it say the word was filled, or the earth was filled with light, and there was no void? It was all meaningful and plentiful existence in the bounty of God's being. But it doesn't say that. This is a very bleak picture, and I believe it's for a reason. It's to show us that this is not our home. This is not where we are meant to live forever and ever. The paradise, the Garden of Eden, was never from the beginning meant to be God or man's dwelling place forever and ever. It was just simply a stage, a set piece of existence for man to come to a determination or a conclusion that would lead him on to the next step. To me, this is real. This is all temporary. It's all impermanent, and yet it serves an eternal purpose. We also see that the scope of the creation is very brief. He created everything within a span of 6 days. We get into a lot of arguments nowadays because science seems to indicate that it's not that way, and yet I doubt what science has to say from the standpoint that we have no absolute capacity to measure. There is nothing in this physical realm that has the term absolute applied to it other than vanity. There is no absolute standard. We can get it pretty close, we think, but is it really close enough to, with authority, describe the parameters of our existence from beginning to end? Do we know that? Can we see it? Can we, with all assurity, say that it's true? To me, it's very interesting when you have men who trust in these type of things. I remember reading an article in Time magazine by a physicist, and she was very brilliant. The article was wonderfully written, and she was putting all of her eggs in the basket of science. This is where the real strength of mankind rests, and we need to focus on this. And she was, I thought, dishonorable to the idea of faith. Faith is just sort of a bygone thing. It's sort of a superstition. We need to deal with the empirical world and the things that we can find. But the trouble with this, she did not address the problem of sin, the problem of man's corruption. Everyone who deals even with empirical evidence is prone to corruption. There's pride, there's cheating, there's the desire for grant money. What will you do? How many figures will you fudge? What will you do to get your name out there so that your work can be promoted? Did she give any guarantees that those who are deigning to define the parameters of our existence know what they're talking about because they are of a high moral caliber, that they will always tell the truth? Do we have assurance along that line? No, we don't. We know that they lie. We know that they cheat. We know that they're just human beings. We know that they wear underwear the same way we do, and they have problems. They get sick and they die. And they're telling us the parameters of our existence. Here we have God describing it. And it's God who set this down. Now, I can't scientifically explain this. Can you? Can you try to define this in scientific terms? Well, if you can't, does that mean that you throw it out the window and wait for a day when you can, or listen to those who say they can? Well, what about this proposition? Do you believe that Jesus has risen from the dead? Is your hope based on the fact that one has risen from the dead to die no more, and you want to be a part of that resurrection? Prove that scientifically. What are the mechanics of the resurrection? Can we define that? Can we get into the subatomic structure of Jesus' body and how it coalesced together to die no more, to come forth from the grave? Who's going to do that? It's beyond us. It's outside of our realm of existence. Why do we believe these things then, if we can't explain them? Well, we believe them because they testify to us of our existence, and they testify so acutely that we find ourselves as human beings, as mortals, standing in guilt before our Creator. And that's something that rings true. We know who we are because the testimony points the finger directly at us. We can see the witness of our being when we look into these pages, these sacred pages of truth, because it reflects on who we are and how we stand in life. And there's no holds barred, he shows us, but it's all done in hope that we might live, and it presents to us a great hope. When the Bible says, he called the night a light day, and darkness he called night, so the evening and the morning were the first day. When it says that, it gives us the pulsation of time. We can see time at work. Time as we know it, the contrast of darkness and light. Darkness and light. We get the concept of a day and a night, and the day and the night combined together have the general term applied to it. The day. It's the day. The first day, second day, so on. Day and night working together. Light and darkness. Now, this is how it works. We have a pulsation of time. Some people try to apply 1,000 years to a day and 1,000 years to a night. Who knows if we had instruments back in those days to measure it as we measure today? Who knows how it would be calibrated? But the effect would still be the same. Man would still wake up in the morning and he would still go to bed at night, no matter how you would calibrate that day or night. It's a pulsation. It's a basic standard that God has put here. And so we can see how he's defined life. He's defined the day and the night, the creation for the first 6 days as a pulsation of light and darkness that we equate with our day and night today. And there are no apologies for this. In other words, it's apology from the standpoint of looking at it, well, you know, it's sort of a weak, kind of a fabulous sort of thing. It's not that way at all. This is God's definition, and we should be at peace with it, just as we are at peace with trusting that Jesus did rise from the dead, that he called Lazarus forth from the grave. The information is just as fantastic any way you look at it. All right, so we see mankind coming into existence, and if we'll drop to verse 27, it says, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. This term image is kind of interesting. Made in the image of God, we are made to be like God. We are of his shadow, his phantom. There's something about us that's very much like him, something that he can relate to. Now, this same word, image, later on, is used to apply to idolatry. When the Bible speaks of making images, it's the same word. But God made an image. He made you. He made me. We're after his image. We are made in his image. We are stylized to be like him. Now, if I try to mold some little clay figurine, how marvelous it might be or how shoddy it might look, it still has vast limitations. We don't expect it to breathe. We don't expect it to communicate with us. We don't expect it to relate to us on our level at all. No one does, except perhaps idolaters who somehow will bow down before images. And they usually say, well, I'm praying to the concept. I'm not praying to the image. Then why have the image there? You just have the concept. But be that as it may, men do bow down before their images. God does not bow down before us, but he loves us. And he does respect us. He respects us from the standpoint that he speaks truth to us. And he treats us as responsible beings. He placed the man and woman in a garden, and he gave them responsibility. He formed man out of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Man became a living soul, and within that capacity, responsibility was given. And the final, I guess you could say, measure of responsibility, I believe, is found in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Isn't it interesting? If you go to the second chapter of the book of Genesis, where it speaks of the creation, the latter part of the first chapter, verse 31, God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good. And then we go into the second chapter, and verse 17, it says, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. It was very good for that to be there. Now, to me, this is kind of an interesting thing to think about, that we have this tree, and it's just described as the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If we can imagine a fruit that has some kind of a capacity to impart unto the eater knowledge that he didn't have before, the knowledge of good and evil. Now, it is apparent that it was good for that to be there. Encased in the skin of that fruit, you might say, the potential for evil existed toward mankind, and yet it was very good that that was there. Well, how could such a thing be very good? Why was that potential for evil placed in the midst of the garden? Why was that good? God said it was all very good. Well, I believe it has to do with the will. There was very good that we should be responsible. Think of a way of living where when you wake up in the morning, that the whole possibility of life is before you, and there's absolutely nothing wrong. Everything is good. Any prospect that comes to mind that you want to apply yourself to, it's there, and the capacity to do it rests within your power. It's all there before you, except for one thing, just one thing, one little thing, and that's that tree. You don't eat it. You stay away from that tree. That means that it's all based then on what you're going to do. It's like it's a counterpoint to the mind. I have this world before me of good, and I should stay away from that. So it's all going to be based on a choice. I want to do this. I'm going to stay away from that. There's the capacity for choice. There's the capacity for will contained, I think, within that creation. And God said that was very good. It was good for human beings to be able to stand up and be responsible for doing good, because that's what it enabled them to do. And yet we see that Adam and Eve turned away from that responsibility, and they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We have the falling from life. And there was an appeal because of its prospect for food. It was good to look upon. And there was the prospect of being made like God, to be made wise like God. And even God admitted this truth. If you remember in the third chapter in verse 22, Genesis 3:22, the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, to know good and evil. And now, lest he put out his hand and take also the tree of life," he's become like one of us. It makes me think it's probably maybe a little like the way we have responsibilities as adults that children cannot bear. And we recognize that it's dangerous for children to try to bear these responsibilities. We don't put things on their shoulders that they cannot bear, and we're very careful about that. We want them to gain some basic responsibilities first. We have a nice set of sharp knives in the kitchen, and I love to use a sharp knife. I enjoy cooking from time to time, and I like to be able to chop the vegetables and to do it swiftly, and you have a nice keen edge. I like that. But that's not something you would give to a two-year-old. Here, this is a really great tool. You ought to try it sometime. You want to help me chop the mushrooms? You know, you just wouldn't do that because you recognize that they can't handle it, and great trouble could come out of it. They could hurt themselves. They could kill themselves. They could kill somebody else, not thinking about it. Little children love to play. Wow! You know, and they might end up hurting somebody. And so we usually keep little children away from things like this. We keep them away from sex. We keep them away from many things that adults know about because it's not time. They're not strong enough. They're not of age to handle these things. And yet, when the time is right, they're able to handle it. There's a measure of responsibility that's gained. My conviction is the same thing here. Now, of course, we're just talking about hypotheticals, about potentials. But what if, for example, Adam and Eve had done the right thing? Now, we gather that the plan of God from the very beginning was not the Garden of Eden. It always has been that we should be with the Lord in eternity, that we should share with the Word of God the eternal glory of God and the inheritance of His beauty and all that's there within His realm. This has been God's design from the beginning. So I think we can conclude from that if Adam and Eve had been faithful, if in a period of time it had been demonstrated that mankind is capable of responsibility, I believe they would have been moved up along the line, that they would have ascended into something better, or perhaps the world just would have been transformed around them. I don't know how that would work, but because the outcome of what Jesus has given us, and it was planned from before the foundation, because that outcome is greater than what they had in the garden, it must make us think that end was always in God's mind. He always had that in mind for us. So, if man had done the right thing, there would have been ultimately a reward. And isn't it interesting when man did the wrong thing, he was denied access to the tree of life, lest he should stretch forth his hand, take of that fruit, and live forever? It's like God didn't want us to live forever in a condition where sin is with us. We see several things happening all at once. When they ate of that fruit, they saw that they were naked. Now, they were naked all along, but it says they saw. Now, what does that mean? Well, they must have perceived it in a way that they had never seen before, in a way that they weren't supposed to see. They saw it in a condition of vulnerability, we might say, because they hid themselves. They made coverings for themselves. Why did they do that? Well, evidently, it wasn't comfortable to them in this new way of seeing things, because, well, we do know they had an adversary in their midst. They had someone in their midst who was watching them and who was a part of their lives now, who hadn't been there. Perhaps they felt that. Perhaps they sensed that. They knew that an enemy was in the camp. I don't know, but there was something that drove them to want to cover themselves, whereas before they had no concern about it at all. And it wasn't just animal simplicity. I don't believe it was that way at all. These were intelligent beings. These were this was a man and a woman with the capacity to communicate with God. And they saw things the way God saw things, but now they saw things from a condition of corruption, vulnerability. Death is here. It started eating at them on the inside, and it would come out on the outside with God denying them. He just gave them the fruit of their efforts by denying them access to the tree of life. Here in chapter 3, verse 14, the Lord said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, You're cursed more than all cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between her seed, your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and conception. In pain you shall bring forth children, and your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And then to Adam, the latter part of verse 17, cursed is the ground for your sake, and toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, for thorns and thistles shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field, and the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Basic conditions were established here because of sin. And one of the things we see here is these conditions are difficult, but they were not without hope. What do we see in the spoken word to the serpent? Now, the serpent represented the power of Satan. That was Satan's tool, you might say, to get to the man and woman. And he was successful in doing this. Do you think God was really interested in just the snake itself? You know, crawl on your belly. Well, I'm sure there was something there. There must have been an awareness in that creature, perhaps a measure of intelligence there that he allowed this. I don't entirely understand that. But I believe ultimately the Lord was speaking about the power of Satan when he's addressing the serpent, because he speaks of one who would come, an enmity. From the seed of the woman, there would be one who would come who would bruise or crush the head, and his heel would be bruised in turn. In other words, he would suffer damage, but there would be an enmity. There would be a separation. Something would give that would change the condition that they now were facing, the problem of sin. Something would cause an alleviation of that condition. So Adam and Eve, though they had hardship placed on them because of their sin, they also had hope that there's going to be something good finally will come out of this. There's going to be a crushing of that power that they had succumbed to. Now, here we have death placed upon them. Out of it you were taken, dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Is this a good thing? Was this a good thing? Well, it was the best thing that could be done in the light of their sin. This is what God imposed upon us to help us along the way. Somebody might say, well, what kind of help is that? You know, why don't you just ease up a little bit? It's just a little sin, you know. But evidently it was profound enough that we're still affected by it this day. But there is something proper and good about death. Let's go to the book of Romans in the 8th chapter. I'd like to start with verse 18. It is written, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. Now, I take this to mean that when it speaks of the creation, it's talking about our mortality, our bodies of flesh and blood. We want to live. We don't want to die in flesh. We want to preserve our lives. It's in our very nature to try to extend our lives. Most of us, if we believe that a trip to the doctor is going to make a difference, we'll take that trip because we want to live longer. We want to enjoy our children and our grandchildren. We want to move on as far as we can in life. That's natural. The earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. We want to live forever. And who are the sons of God? The sons of God are you and me, or anyone who has been born again. There's a beginning. The beginning is on the inside. Just as it was with Adam and Eve when they fell, death started on the inside. And dying, you will die. They didn't instantly shrivel up and die. The fruit wasn't poisoned, but death already took place in their inner man. They were cut off from God's goodwill. They were no longer harmonious with him. They were afraid. They hid when his voice was speaking to them. Something very terrible had happened. Death had happened to them, and it touched their inner man. So also does life touch our inner man. When we are born again, it's real. It's true. It's not just a saying, you're born again, but it's a reality. A new beginning occurs. A new character starts to emerge. A development of that character occurs that becomes good instead of evil, becomes beneficial, becomes neighborly, becomes a type of person that other people rely upon, and that ultimately has the potential to bring good the hope of salvation to others. This is a very real thing in being born again. Now, what is the manifestation of the sons of God? Well, the manifestation is when that born-again soul is united with a body that will not die. I think we can get a picture of manifestation back in the book of Matthew, the 13th chapter, where it gives us the parable of the sower and the one who sowed the tares in the field. And this is the description of the outcome of all of that. Here in Matthew 13, 41, the Son of Man will send out his angels. They will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Doesn't that sound like the same thing here when it says, the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. The righteous shall shine forth in the kingdom of their Father. In other words, we will come into the fullness of what God has made us to be. Our bodies yearn for this. We want to live. We want to be free from pain. We want to be free from sorrow. We want to be in a condition where it's not just ethereal, where it's not just an abstraction, but rather the whole being, body, soul, and spirit, are united before the very presence of God in peace and well-being.